Hi, everybody. Eve Harrow, Director of Tourism and Community Development for One Israel Fund. And welcome to our newest webinar for One Israel Fund as we pass the one-year mark into our global pandemic. What One Israel Fund has been doing is not just been sitting around. Even though I have not been able to take people around Israel the way we usually do, we have still many, many projects happening, many people involved. We've also been doing virtual tours, and you can still be a part of what's happening in Judea and Samaria, even though physically you are not here yet, and hopefully you will be here soon. It's February 22nd, 2021. God, this has been a long year already, and just a few days short of Purim. So I am here tonight in Israel with Gil Hoffman, who in addition to being an old and dear friend, is also an incredible journalist, the only person in the world possibly ever to have lectured on Israel in all 50 states of the United States. He agreed to participate in tonight's webinar because, apropos of Purim, we have elections in almost exactly another month here in Israel. And we want to know what's going on from somebody who has interviewed virtually every high-profile politician in Israel. Some of them really are high-profile. Some of them think they're high-profile. Whatever it is, if it's to be known about Israeli politics, you can be sure that Gil Hoffman knows it. So, Gil, thank you so much for joining me here tonight on One Israel Fund's webinar. You there?
I am very much here, and I want to apologize for the technical issues that are still being worked on that have put me in two separate boxes with a little bit of a split personality here.
Okay.
So if you want to hear me, then you can go to the box that just says Gil Hoffman Audio. If you want to see me, I'm speaking out of a different box that says Gil Hoffman Video, but I'm all here in one way or another.
Okay, terrific. Apropos masks that we've all been wearing all year and Purim that's coming up. So you can decide who you want to be at any different moment. Okay, so Gil, so tell us, I mean, what, you know, back to elections again. Give us an idea of what you think is going to be happening. Is there anything, let me ask this question. Is there anything different going into this round than in the last round?
Great question, Eve. Again, thank you so much for having me. And I appreciate all the people coming, including some familiar names who I adore from around the world. And then I think that shows the power of your organization in bringing so many people together on such short notice. And I can feel the love for Israel here in the room, in whatever passes for a room.
The virtual room, yes.
Nowadays that we're all in. Eve, this election is very different than the previous three that we've had. And I realize that this group it leans more one way than other groups do. And I have to tell you, the rule of the right is absolutely in danger in a way that it hasn't been in a very long time. And I think that people don't realize the seriousness of it all.
Okay, how so?
So a number of things have changed that haven't been around before. In the past, Netanyahu had a very strong bloc that included the Russian immigrants from Avigdor Lieberman, the residents of Judea and Samaria through Naftali Bennett, and the ultra-Orthodox together. Well, Lieberman, he lost in the first election, and now Bennett is determined to bring him down. Now, when I say that Bennett is determined to bring him down, it would be one thing if he just was honest about it, the way that Avigdor Lieberman was, because that has an impact. You've got among Avigdor Lieberman's supporters, you've got probably six out of his seven seats wouldn't mind at all if Netanyahu would remain prime minister. But they're voting for a party that's trying to bring Netanyahu down because of Lieberman's personal issues with Netanyahu. Bennett is not being honest the way that Lieberman is. He is straddling the fence in order to win supporters who want Netanyahu replaced and supporters who want Netanyahu to remain in office. Figure out of his 12 seats in the poll, it's probably divided half and half. So you're talking about six seats of Netanyahu supporters who are going to vote for the Amina party of Bennett and Shaked, even though it is very much a part of the anti-Netanyahu bloc. So that is big change number one. Big change number two is that Netanyahu no longer can run against Arabs, which has proven effective in previous campaigns. He warned that they were going to vote in droves. He demonized them, made the elections be about Bibi or Ahmed Tibi. Well, now he can't do that because of his own outreach to Israeli Arabs. He might think that that could bring him votes. I don't see it bringing him too many votes. In fact, I see it losing him votes on the right, who could then vote for other parties, for Gideon Saar's party, for Naftali Bennett's party, in the anti-Netanyahu camp, among people that are genuinely concerned about demographics. The third change is that Netanyahu is on trial. Now, you can mock the charges, you can make fun of them, but it has an effect on voters. Not too many of them, apparently, but it does have an effect on voters that their prime minister, that the charges against him are legitimate enough to bring him to trial. If anything, it rallies his base and always has, because his base thinks it's a witch hunt. But you know, those voters haven't changed, no matter what stage the trial has been in, the legal processes have been in. But now the actual trial hit undecided voters, it can have an impact. The fourth and final change that we haven't had in the first three elections, Eve, is that Donald Trump isn't the president of the United States. Okay, in back of me is a window, and on the other side of that window is the American embassy in Jerusalem. If it weren't dark outside right now, you would see the flag waving from sea to shining sea, or from one part of in back of this window to the other part of in back of this window. It's still there, even though Donald Trump hasn't been the president of the United States for a whole month. The policies about Israel have changed completely. Now, it would be one thing if they've changed completely and everybody knew about it. But Joe Biden, I know we've some people here who voted for him, and some people here, a lot of people here maybe who didn't vote for him. And I'm not going to enter American politics in any way or give an opinion on American politics in any way. I'm going to only say the facts that Joe Biden has not yet spoken about his plans for Israel and the Palestinians and the wider region. And maybe it's because he's only been in power for a month, but maybe it's because he's influencing the Israeli election. If Israeli voters realized how serious those issues are going to be over the next 4 to 8 years, I think that they would be taking them a lot more seriously, and that would help Netanyahu out politically a lot. He may not be hostile to Israel the way that Netanyahu painted Obama to be, but he's certainly someone who takes the future of the land of Judea and Samaria seriously enough, the way Bill Clinton did, that if the people of Israel knew, then they might vote completely differently. And this puts the rule of Netanyahu and the right in jeopardy, in a way that has not happened in a very, very long time. The people of Israel are complacent. The voters don't realize what they're getting into. And if you are a supporter of keeping all of Judea and Samaria right now, you should be downright terrified.
Okay. You mentioned Avigdor Lieberman before. He's getting a lot of seats consistently, 6 to 7 seats. For somebody who is responsible, shall we not forget, for the fact that we've gone into the fourth election now, who's voting for him? What is his sector?
I don't know if my video is frozen here. Russian immigrants, no matter how long they've been in this country, realize that having an Avigdor Lieberman who's strong helps them out. If they could control the absorption ministry, that's one thing, that's great. We're talking about a campaign promise of Lieberman to be finance minister. And any government will give that to him. Nobody else wants that thankless job. And so if I'm a Russian immigrant, I would definitely vote for Avigdor Lieberman, regardless of whether I agree with him on other issues, only on the issue of helping Russian immigrants from the post of finance minister. That's enough. And that's why Anglo voters need to wake up and realize that they've got no one representing them and how important it is. I spoke today to the spokeswoman of Michal Kotler-Wunsch. Michal Kotler-Wunsch,
She was our last webinar, and she made a tremendous impression on all of us. And it's really a shame that she's not going to be back into the Knesset. And she's an incredible woman. Absolutely.
She's working 24 hours a day, 6 days a week,
yeah,
to help English-speaking immigrants to this country and their family around the world. The airport being shut down right now has created hundreds of gut-wrenchingly anguishing cases. She's working on fixing it more than any other human being. We, when she's gone, don't have anyone. There is no one in a realistic slot currently on a list who will get in, who would take those issues under his wing and realize that being the Anglo representative is the most important part of his job. Now, there are other people who might make it a secondary or third part of their job. I had a fascinating interview on the cover of Friday's Jerusalem Post that I hope people saw with a young man named Simcha Rothman, who is number four on the Religious Zionist Party list. His family made Aliyah from Cleveland in 1910, so that does not make him an Anglo. But his wife, her family made Aliyah from Skokie, Illinois, shortly before she was born. And they are raising their children in English in Gush Etzion. And because of that, he is very much part of the Anglo community and intends to be our representative in the next Knesset, and the polls show that he is getting in. We'll have to train him, Eve. We'll have to explain to him.
And there's also Jeremy Sultan, who is on the Amina list, I believe at 13 or 14, who also considers himself.
13. He put a Russian immigrant at 12. He put a French immigrant at number 10. Naftali did not realize how important the Anglo community is. He took it for granted. Putting Jeremy in an unrealistic slot by all polls, even with the Norwegian law, if three ministers quit, he's promised that one of his ministers would be a person who's not a member of Knesset, Chagit Moshe. She would not, that keeps Jeremy one slot away even more from the Knesset. So it's hard. Unless you see him, unless you see the party getting 13, 14 seats in the polls, he won't make it in.
Look, and there are those who say, though, that each sector of Olim doesn't necessarily have to have a representative in the Knesset to take care. Like, we should all just be Israelis and we should trust the members of Knesset to do what every sector needs. That, you know, if the Ethiopians, for example, need something, it could be somebody who made Aliyah from New York who's making sure, which, by the way, is what Michal did, incidentally. She's the head of the committee for the Ethiopians, even though she's from, you know, nowhere near from Ethiopia. So, I mean, maybe that's the ideal situation, is that we don't need representatives. But I hear absolutely what you're saying, especially this last year when it came to travel and other issues. I know that he's no longer a member of Knesset. Dov Lipman was very helpful to a lot of people as well, even though he is no longer in the Knesset. And so it definitely helps to have some kind of, what do they say? You don't need protection as long as you know the right people here in Israel, how that expression goes. We've got a question from one of our listeners, which I will read out. Democracy's genius is the inherent structural condition that through regular elections and observing the requirement of a peaceful transfer of power, it has long become plain that however useful Bibi's rule was early in his long tenure, his modus operandi has been spent. Only new leadership, long deferred, can begin to restore Zion's glory without the presence of corruption and serious entanglements. What is a thoughtful Israeli voter to do? Who are serious contenders to replace Netanyahu for new leadership we must have, as in the United States? And I had seen who signed off on this, and now I don't anymore. We'll get back to that at some point. So what do you say to that, Gil?
It's more complicated than it is in the United States. In the United States, you have an electoral college, and that determines who the next president of the United States will be. In one day. Well, here it will take longer than that. After our election results are in, no one will know who the prime minister of Israel.
Well, actually, in the United States, it took a few weeks too this time, but okay. They're following the Israeli model. How marvelous. Yes. Okay. Oh, Professor Asher J. Matthias. That was his question.
Professor Matthias, it's going to be complicated because the president of Israel has a role in deciding who our next prime minister will be. The president of Israel, Reuven Rivlin, is at the end of his term and at the end of his career, 80 years old, and he absolutely, positively detests Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and has for decades. It's longer than decades. His father hated Netanyahu's father.
Oh my, this is almost sounding biblical here.
His grandfather hated Netanyahu's grandfather, going back to the 1880s in Lithuania. It's been going on that far. And twice, he had no choice but to entrust Netanyahu with forming a government. I say twice, not three times, because the third time, it wasn't him. The third time was the only time after Netanyahu's official indictment. Rivlin does not believe in having an indicted prime minister. And so it happened to go through a stage where it went back to the Knesset. And then with the support of Benny Gantz, Netanyahu was able to form a government,
right,
not through the president. This will be the first election that will test whether Rivlin would enable Netanyahu to form a government. And the answer is he will do everything possible to avoid it. Only if there are 61 seats firmly recommending Netanyahu will he have no choice but to give him that job. Currently in the polls, there are about 50. There are four parties that are in favor of Netanyahu remaining prime minister. Likud, the Sephardi ultra-Orthodox, Shas, the Ashkenazi ultra-Orthodox, United Torah Judaism Party, and the Religious Zionist Party, a member of Knesset Bezalel Smotrich. Only 50. Theoretically, if he pays off Bennett enough, maybe he can jump sides. But there aren't, not in every poll does he have 61, the majority with Bennett either. So let me tell you a scenario that can happen. Okay. Instead of Yair Lapid forming a government, which is what Netanyahu's ads warn of, because Lapid is second firmly in every poll, you could have a situation where the day after election, the New Hope Party of Gideon Saar and the Yamina Party of Naftali Bennett unite into one faction, and they then tell Rivlin, we are one faction led by whichever Bennett or Saar got more votes. We are the second largest party. They will tell that to Lapid and say, okay, you have to let us have the top job, which is prime minister. You can have the second best job, whatever you want that to be, I guess, foreign minister. And then the third one among them will be our defense minister, and Lieberman will be the finance minister. And that's how they would form a government. And they can have all, most of the polls now show that they get 61 seats for the anti-Netanyahu bloc. And that could happen.
Wow. So, you know, you brought it up, so we'll jump into that. How is it that virtually everyone that has worked with Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu over the years can't stand him? How the leaders of a good number of the parties that are running now are people who once worked with him, were loyal to him, and have now left. And for example, you also have Zev Elkin, who was very, very loyal to him, who now moved over to Gideon Saar. What I'm trying to get at here is that you can be an incredible prime minister, and I hear how much respect you have for Bibi Netanyahu. And of course, all of us sitting here, I've had two vaccines, you've had two vaccines. There's a lot going on here in Israel that I think we need to give him the thanks for. He got on the phone with the head of Pfizer and made sure that Israel is way ahead of everybody on what's happening here. And that is nothing short of really life-changing. And the Abraham Accords and other things that have happened here. But going back to also Professor Matathias's question, in addition to the people running in other parties, who it's, you know, anybody but, among the voters, there is a sense of Bibi fatigue. I don't know how else to put it. Even among people who respect him and understand the things that he's done and understand the dangers of which you opened this webinar, that unless he is prime minister, as you see it, Israel's in danger of not having a government that goes to the right. What is it about this man that, even despite all the really marvelous things he has done, the great intelligence that he has, and nobody can deny that, the grasp of the economy and things like that, what is it that has, I don't know, maybe I'm putting words in your mouth, Israelis almost willing to shoot themselves in the foot in order to not see Bibi and Sarah on Balfour Street anymore? You've met with him, you've met with people around him. I'm sorry if I'm having you jump into this, but it's just, it's this like glaring question that's always out there. What has this man done to engender so much dislike? And that's, I'm putting it mildly.
Personality, ego, personality, arrogance, and a feeling that it's time for other people to have a shot, which is a legitimate feeling, even among people that respect the prime minister for the vaccines and the Abraham Accords, the peace agreements reached with Arab and Muslim countries, and every other accomplishment that he's had. And the feeling is that even though the Likud campaign says that he's this leader among politicians, that every other country in the world has then shifted from someone more experienced to someone less experienced, and they've managed to survive. And that we would too. That the next prime minister of Israel, whether it's in 3 months or 30 years, is going to be less experienced than the current prime minister. And that's a fact. And there are people who've chosen to put personality and ego over ideology. Those are some of the voters. If you have enough of those voters who agree with Netanyahu's ideology but still want him replaced, then he can lose this election.
That may very well be what happens. Yeah, that may very well be what happens because of a lot of the things that you mentioned here. And also, I must say, as somebody who lives in Judea, who lives in Gush Etzion, as someone who's here on a webinar that's being sponsored by an organization that is very much devoted to continued building and Jewish communities and Jewish settlement in Judea and Samaria, there's a sense of frustration as we look around and we see the Palestinian Authority taking over land, even in Area C, land that was originally supposed to be for different Jewish communities out here, is now being taken over by the Palestinian Authority, of course, funded by the Europeans, that we see the desecration of holy sites completely against the Oslo Accords, like what happened a few days ago in with Joshua's altar. And that's maybe the most blatant example and the best known example. But those of us who know what's going on have been seeing other things happening already for years, including maybe the most especially the Temple Mount. And that a supposedly right-wing prime minister has not stopped it and has let these things go on. And so I think there's also a sense of frustration. It's not just an irrational dislike of the man and saying, okay, it's enough already. You know, we need to, as experienced as you are, we need somebody new in there. There's also a sense that certain things that make Israel strong from the inside are not happening, that there's weakness here. Yeah.
I'm going to have to stop you there because I think that you're asking too much.
Okay.
If you think the grass is greener with somebody else that more to the right, watch how that person more to the right then cast a cave into pressure that he'll be under from the international community. What he does then, we don't know. One of the most fascinating elections I've ever seen was when I visited Ireland. I was in Ireland on this date 5 years ago. I just saw it in my Facebook memories today. And it was an election there on the economy. And Ireland was acknowledged at the time to have the best economy on the face of the earth.
Right.
And the people of Ireland thought the grass is greener somewhere else. It's not. It's greenest in Ireland. I saw it. And I just didn't understand how these voters were voting out a leader who had given them the world's best economy.
Which it isn't anymore.
It's not anymore, right? So yeah. So don't find yourself assuming that somebody else can be more right-wing. You'll find yourself with Yair Lapid as prime minister, which is very much a possibility. Be careful. It could be that Gideon Saar and Naftali Bennett will be prime minister, but Lapid also very much has a chance of being prime minister.
Well, there's a glaring, of course, similarity here to the American elections, where people who like Trump's policies didn't vote for him because they didn't like him and now have found themselves with a different kind of administration than perhaps they're very excited about. So it's just, it's so crazy because with all the high tech and with all the virtual everything, it still comes down to people. It still comes down to people and their personalities and the way they rub other people the right way or the wrong way. Despite what their actions are. I think it's great that people still play a large role in humanity, people's personalities. But, you know, it sometimes leads us to make mistakes or, you know, do things that look antithetical to what our interests are. There's a couple of other questions here. I'll just paraphrase. Iran and Iraq, which, you know, we don't necessarily pay so much attention to, but there's a looming danger, especially from Iran, and possibly with shifting views from Europe and from the American administration. Is the Iranian issue going to impact the Israeli elections, or we're too focused on some of the internal things here, the COVID pandemic, the economic issues that we're coming out of now?
At first, I thought the question in Iran was just about whether it's a big deal, question shifted into whether it's going to have an impact on the Israeli election, and the answers are the opposite, right? It's a huge deal.
Oh, yeah.
The Israeli government is meeting about it right now as we speak, about how to handle the American administration's change of policies on Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And will it have an impact on how people vote? Absolutely zero. Because people don't realize yet how big a deal it is.
Right.
They don't realize how serious Joe Biden intends to take the issue, how serious Blinken and others in the administration intend to take the issue. And that allows them, because they're not voting on such things, to vote, as you said, on COVID and on just a general dislike as to how the situation's been over the last year, which is terrible for any incumbent, and any number of issues, personality issues, as we've talked about.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about the other people that are running. Do you see any of them as... obviously, they're not experienced. None of them have been prime minister before. Do you see anyone who has the potential to be? I don't know if I'm going into like, I don't want your personal opinion on this, but more of an analysis since you've met all of them. Maybe some of their strengths, some of their weaknesses. For example, something just came out recently. I think it was Bennett put out his economic policy. Other people also have economic policies. Would you like to see that being discussed now in the weeks coming before the elections, away from the personalities? What is everybody's economic policy to get Israel out of the downturn that we've had because of COVID? Like more of a, you know, well, I guess that's also a very emotional issue, but more of a real like tachlis. I don't know how you say tachlis in English anymore. It's probably not even Hebrew. You know, more of like a real debate on a serious issue like that.
We're not going to have any debates on serious issues.
Not going to be.
Unfortunately, our elections have become very shallow, even worse than the United States. In America, they have debates. I really respect that. I wish we had them here. I'm going to be hosting through Mizrahi, the closest thing we can get to a debate, where I will have six party leaders telling people how to vote for them. I couldn't get them in a single room, but we can make it as if we did through the wonders of technology nowadays. So on the 7th of March, plugging that, that's going to go online on the World Mizrahi website. Naftali Bennett has decided that the way for him to get support is to focus on professionalism. On his plans for helping the economy, for dealing with the impact of COVID-19 on the people of Israel. And I definitely respect him for doing that. He's tried to shift away from the traditional right-wing issues where people would support him regardless. And he can consider those people in his pocket in one way or another, and therefore not have to worry about it. And try to woo new voters by focusing on more national issues that impact everyone. Personality-wise, he definitely has the leadership to be a leader of Israel one day. And Gideon Saar also has those leadership abilities. He's only been education minister and interior minister, not defense minister, as Bennett has, though only for a few months. But he definitely proved himself capable in those ministerial roles of being a figure who can bring a lot of people together across the political spectrum. And that's very necessary following a pandemic. And that leaves us with Lapid. You know, four people were declared candidates for prime minister. Lapid is not as shallow as people, as the image that he's acquired for, I don't know, being women say good looking or being an anchor man in the past. But he has a depth to him that I think hasn't come through enough. Has gotten to understand the issues facing the ordinary Israeli in a very serious kind of way. He's certainly not as left-wing as Netanyahu has made him out to be. And if I'm a right-wing Israeli, if Lapid became prime minister, it's not the end of the world the way it would be if Meirav Mikhaeli became prime minister.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of Meirav Mikhaeli, what do you think of the Israeli left here, of what's happening to the party that founded the state? Where do you see them heading in this particular election? Because it seems that the Israeli public shifts to the right after all the terrorism and what happened post-Oslo. From the polls that I read, and please elaborate on that, it seems that that's kind of here to stay. The voters, the young voters, the 18, 19, and 20-year-olds, those who are now in the army or just finished the army, grew up in the shadow of a lot of that, do not have a tremendous amount of trust, shall we say, for the Palestinian Authority. And it seems like the Israeli left, or Peace Now, is not where it wants to be or where it used to be. Do you think this is kind of their last hurrah, or you think there's still a place here in Israeli politics for them? And I'm saying Meretz and Labor are kind of in a mishmash together.
Sure. The left didn't die and won't die. They are smaller, and a large percentage of young Israelis being either ultra-Orthodox or Russian immigrants, children of Russian immigrants, or from the traditional Likud base in development towns and inner cities, and religious Zionists in Judea and Samaria and other communities that all would not traditionally vote for the Labor Party, definitely hurts its ability to resurrect itself and merits further to the left. But they'll never die. There will always be hardcore people who believe that Israel immediately needs two states for two peoples for its own good, for demographic and other reasons, and want to cooperate more with the world and take that very seriously. Regular liberal left-wing values that are the same values around the world that they believe in. So there are a lot fewer of them, but if with the right kind of leadership, and for Meirav, who's a very nice person, she can bring them up a little bit, but with the right kind of leadership, that you can have somebody who can bring them up by a lot in another election or two. I just don't know who that person is yet.
Well, we might have, you know, more elections in another 4 or 5 months, so maybe they could get someone by then with the way things are going. How about the ultra-Orthodox parties, both the Ashkenazim and the Sephardim, to put it like that? Do you see them just wanting to be in any government? They don't really care. They want the funding, as you said also about the Russians earlier in the program. They want the funding for their yeshivot to maintain a certain lifestyle, to not be leaned on, to go into the army, et cetera, the things that that they're not for. Do you see them being a key actor here? They seem to be polling each about 7, something like that, right? There's steady numbers that they get. You see them just going with whomever's going to form the government just so that they get what they need and not really being that ideologically inclined, or they do lean more to one way or the other, despite what people might think?
First of all, the ultra-Orthodox have to be given credit for being excellent public servants. Their politicians have served them extremely well, their constituency, in giving them everything possible that they can get out of the government. And I'm not saying that in a negative way in any way, just like any congressman and senator in the United States would do. And I want to single out the only American in the Knesset right now is Yitzhak Pindrus, from the United Torah Judaism Party, who is doing a lot to help Anglos behind the scenes. It doesn't make the waves. It doesn't do the PR that Michal does, but definitely deserves to be given credit. So that's all in a positive sense. On the negative sense, the people of Israel are very angry at the ultra-Orthodox. The people of Israel are not ultra-Orthodox. Those 88% of the people, including the modern Orthodox religious Zionists and whatever they want to be called, are absolutely furious that the ultra-Orthodox have not done enough to listen to the laws to prevent the pandemic from spreading. Israel would be doing a lot better if they had followed those laws. And it's absolutely unacceptable that they've chosen to be above the law with the funerals with the thousands of people and the schools opening when other people weren't opening their schools. That frustration boils over and it makes people vote for people like Lapid and Lieberman who try to unite the masses against them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, there's an anti-Bibi movement, but there also seems to be an anti-Haredi movement. And I would say that that's who a lot of Lieberman's people are, who are very, very much against the ultra-Orthodox. And something that I think not everybody really knows, there's a large sector of those who made Aliyah from the former Soviet Union who have halachic issues here in Israel, who made Aliyah under the law of return, which is also through the father, but it butts up against Jewish law, against halacha, which is that you're Jewish if it's through the maternal line. And so you have Israelis who are technically not Jewish who are running into a lot of problems when it comes to the life cycle events that have to go through the rabbinate in Israel, which is controlled by the ultra-Orthodox, when it comes to getting married and other life cycle events. And that is because I think that that's probably a good chunk of Lieberman's voters as well, who are looking for some kind of change there. And that's actually a very big issue in Israel that I don't think enough is being done about, and has been kind of kicked down the road. But it's an issue that's just getting bigger and bigger. So the last big sector that we haven't spoken about, of course, is the Arab sector. And you mentioned at the beginning that in previous elections, Bibi has done almost like a fear-mongering, especially even on the day of the elections, go out and vote, the Arabs are voting en masse. And he's changed his tune this time around. Why do you say that is?
Because somebody took a poll for him that found out that he could get 3 Arab seats, which could make
that simple.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He also, after cooperating with Mansour Abbas, a member of Knesset from the Muslim party in the Knesset, couldn't legitimately run against them when he's been cooperating with them. So after doing that, he tried to make the best of the situation. He put an Arab on his list, but not in a realistic slot after a lot of speculation that he would give an Arab a realistic slot. Then he didn't. But people think he did. They didn't make much noise that he only gave him slot number 39. Mm-hmm. People see him as now reaching out to the Israeli Arabs. In the end, people will do anything to get votes, even if it's an election.
But did you find that interesting that the poll said that he could get 3 votes from the Arab sector? Do you think that's true?
No.
No.
I don't. I think the poll is kind of exaggerated. Other polls have said different since then.
Mm-hmm.
No. If anything, what he's accomplished is he's split up the joint Arab list. Right. Arabs are much more likely to vote if they're united. You had a record 64% Arab turnout in the last election, mm-hmm. Which was still not the 71% turnout in general. But I'm from Chicago. Okay, we last had an election for mayor a year ago, where the turnout was in the 20s. My lost here again. So we to have 64% Arab turnout is absolutely incredible. And keep in mind, in Chicago, half those voters were dead.
I was going to say, Chicago sometimes gets 200% turnout. Yeah, so it's one or the other. So if we're already talking about the Arabs, do you see that they've become more Israeli? That they feel that they not necessarily are jumping up and down when they sing Hatikvah, but they understand the value of being in Israel, the value of living in a democratic society, which are few and far between, shall we say, in the rest of the Middle East. And not even just getting COVID shots, but getting an education and really being able to fulfill themselves in many ways in an open society. Do you feel that they're appreciating Israel more, that they feel more Israeli than they used to be? There's some kind of movement in that direction?
The polls say that Israeli Arabs feel just as comfortable living here as Jews do. The Israel Democracy Institute takes a very serious poll every year called the Israel Democracy Index. And that poll says that they're very proud to be Israeli when and they like living here. And part that comes from the great social services that we provide here right. in Israel that they don't have in other countries in this region, no doubt about it.
Mm-hmm. So you feel positive about that, about the movement in that sense?
I don't see them rebelling or becoming any kind of fifth column or anything. If anything, mm-hmm. the children have become more acquiescing to their situation and realizing that this is their home.
Well, when we get back to the Israeli elections, of course, and the need to cobble together at least 61, it could be that at some point in the future, do you think that the Arab party or parties, depending on what's happening in their sector, will one day join a government? Because look, my sense, and I'm not the only Israeli, is that from the Arabs that I know in Israeli society, is that their leaders really don't accurately reflect them, that their leaders are much more anti-Israel, vocal, are not doing really what they should.
The Arab politicians do not serve their people well mm-hmm. the way that the ultra-Orthodox politicians do. They do not provide their people with the proper services the way that the ultra-Orthodox do. The fact that they don't join a coalition because of the Palestinian issue that has nothing to do with the Israeli Arab citizens
right.
hurts their people. Because of that, they get less infrastructure, less education funding, and everything that affects their everyday lives is worse. And it's mm-hmm. not racism, even though it looks it. It's just bad mm-hmm. politics.
Mm-hmm.
For that to change, there needs to be different leadership, because even when, today, Yair Lapid in a speech said he had no problem having the Joint Arab List in his coalition, which is a big change that he said in the past. But he said, I'm an Oda, the leader of the Joint Arab List, won't want to join.
Right.
Well, so in the end, they need to have leaders that are willing to cooperate. The fact that Mansour Abbas talked about doing this, and it is possible that his party that broke off the Joint List will join, will pass the threshold, then you could very much have an Arab party that would be in a coalition, no matter who among the four different potential prime ministers takes power.
Mm-hmm.
That would be a fascinating change.
Yes.
I think we're changing very quickly in that effect.
Mm-hmm. So there is something that I think a lot of our listeners or our viewers, yes, might relate to here. And to come back to something that you said in terms of representation, either for American Olim or Russian Olim or different sectors and the ultra-Orthodox and the Arabs, one of the fascinating things that has happened over the last few years is with the religious Zionist sector, if you will, the Kippah Sruga, the people who make up maybe the bulk or at least the ideological driving force behind the settlement movement, behind the Jews living in Judea and Samaria, who are not really going with the party. Right, that you find keep awareness, first of all, among as in political sphere in virtually every party, and you don't find everybody saying, you would think that, say, in Judea and Samaria, every single city or every single town would vote for party X because that is the party that best promotes the needs of Judea and Samaria. And what's so fascinating is that, and I see it as someone who lives here, as someone who served on the local council in Efrat for over a decade, you don't have that sectorial attitude here, even with such a big issue. I mean, the issue of Judea and Samaria like makes global headlines. It's not just an Israeli issue. You find people voting for different reasons. You find people in very many different parties, also religiously spread, also in terms of, do we want socialism? Do we want private economy? How do you explain that? Is there an explanation?
The religious Zionists have integrated in all the top echelons of Israeli society and therefore don't feel that they need to vote as a bloc anymore. And that has killed what was the National Religious Party and then by
right.
DVD. They feel that they've integrated inside Likud and the ruling party, and so they're okay now. I think that only if you have a government formed that does not include religious Zionists, then they'll start to realize, oh, wait a second, what have we done? And since I don't expect that to happen in this election, where Naftali Bennett will be part of any government,
mm-hmm.
It's not going to happen now. And so that drift will continue to happen. It's interesting that the Russian immigrants have stayed together, 30 years after their family made Aliyah, whereas the religious Zionists have completely dispersed.
Or as you said, whether it's a good thing or a bad thing, have very much integrated into Israeli society, into the army for sure, in droves, and into all the factories, all the workplaces, and just feel, very much Israeli with the exact same issues, no matter where they live. Look, Avigdor Lieberman, for those who don't know, lives in Nokdim. He lives in eastern Gush Etzion, as does Zev Elkin. He lives in Kfar Eldad, not far from there, two very different men from two very different parties, but not necessarily in parties right now where that it has become the driving force behind what they do, as opposed to, let's say, Bezalel Smotrich, who is, that's clearly his passion and where he's going for just in the few months that he had as transportation minister, where I understand he did an excellent job. He was able to get roads budgeted through some very problematic areas in Judea and Samaria that needed bypass roads that had been held up for many, many years, and he was able to get that through. So that was very much, and there's a big difference between a Bezalel Smotrich, who that is, and he makes it very clear that that is his priority, and others. So it's just an interesting thing to see over as in one, on the one hand, Judea and Samaria still don't have Israeli law here, still don't have sovereignty, still very much up in the air. And as we said, a lot of issues with illegal Palestinian Authority building in Area C and roads not done and environmental issues that are not being taken care of, etc. Yet to some degree, the people living in Judea and Samaria are not in crisis mode. Maybe we could put it that way, because that's how we started off this webinar with you talking about that.
Mm-hmm. Eve, they don't realize, and I think this will also answer Karen Staldon's question in the chat about how what would wake up right-wing voters.
Mm-hmm. So answer it for all of us. Yeah.
If Joe Biden does or says anything, they're going to realize what we've gotten ourselves into. Which is not an Obama situation, but a Clinton situation. That's a very serious what Bill Clinton tried to do. Tried to set a final border for the state of Israel that did not include a lot of Judea and Samaria. And right. Joe Biden's going to try to do that as well with an international community with a lot more legitimacy, with Donald Trump not being there and wanting to be the anti-Trump and the entire world wanting to be the anti-Trump, especially if COVID proceeds in being solved, please God, in other countries after it happens here, then they'll go back to looking at us again. Mm-hmm. And if there will be any situation that requires the President of the United States to say something, to reveal his plans, maybe it will be when they work on starting to appoint ambassadors or when there are big speeches coming up, and the Munich speech that there was this week could have been one of those. We bypassed that pretty successfully. It can still happen that between now and March 23rd, that something will come out about what he believes in or what he intends to do. And that will wake up those right-wing voters in Israel, and they either take votes away from Lapid that are right-wing and give them to one of the other non-Netanyahu candidates, or among the people who feel are right wing but are decided that they feel comfortable voting for an anti-Netanyahu party. Maybe it would move them back to Netanyahu. There's a lot of impact that can be had from one little sentence by the President of the United States that could still happen.
And you think that's why he's probably not going to do it, because he very much realizes the impact he can have now on the Israeli elections? And to just, excuse the pun, bide his time?
He knows the players here. Mm-hmm. And the famous quote from Joe Biden to Netanyahu was, I love you, Bibi, but I disagree with everything you say. Having a president of the United States like that has to be taken seriously by the right-wing voters, and will be if he does end up saying something, and especially people in Judea and Samaria.
I've been in touch with my tour operator over the last few weeks, because there are people that I need to see that I haven't seen in over a year, and a granddaughter I've never even met. And so with the airport closed, a lot of people are in the same situation, trying to get out, trying to move around. And he said to me the other day that he is shocked at how many people are going to be leaving Israel before March 23rd. And when he reminds them that it's the Israeli election, they say, yeah, we know. And since there's no absentee ballot in Israel, if you are not unless you're in foreign service or I think in the security services, but other regular citizens, if you're not physically in Israel on election day, you cannot vote. And there's just, and he said, there's a lot of people who say, I can't, I just can't anymore. There's too many elections. Nothing seems to change. No matter how many elections we have, we seem to get a dysfunctional government that can't pass a budget, that just kind of has a lot of committee meetings, but it doesn't really feel that anything is moving forward. What would you say to people like that? As an Israeli, as a journalist, as someone who is so passionately, and I've known you for a long time, involved in Israel and not more knowledgeable than 99.99% of the people living here behind the scenes. And I know that with all that you've shared with us tonight, and you've been very honest, and I really appreciate that. I know there's a lot that you cannot talk about, that you've heard, that people have told you, that you're not privy to share with us. So what would you say to people who say, like, it doesn't really matter anyhow? What's the difference? Whoever gets in there, it's going to be the same old, same old.
That's so sad, Eve.
I know.
Because, you know, the most fun that I have and probably the most important thing I do professionally is brief college students from the United States who currently obviously can't come here. You know, right. The post-birthright programs like Hasbara fellowships train the top Israel advocates to go there on college campuses and be both proactive and reactive. And also the emissaries from the Jewish Agency who are doing absolutely wonderful work on college campuses in the program that Natan Sharansky still leads. I've been just so impressed. And the reason why they always have an expert in Israeli democracy brief them is because Israeli democracy is part of what sells Israel best. It's something that young North Americans can relate to.
Right.
And I guess I can understand why over the last 2 years that's become less of something to be proud of if we've had four elections in 2 years. But it doesn't have to be that way. I believe that the next government will be more stable, will last, that this is just an episode that's passing. A lot of it has to do with Netanyahu and his trial. It's not cynical in saying that. He did put his legal fate above other key issues. Including passing a budget, and we have been in Israel limited by Netanyahu and him having other priorities, rightly or wrongly. And once he is no longer there, or once his trial is no longer there, those won't be a factor anymore, and you could deal less on personal issues coming from the prime minister's office and more on helping the people.
But that could be years.
It could be. It could be. Netanyahu could win another 4 years in power. And, one of the things that the member of Knesset from the right that I spoke to, Simcha Rothman, said was that it doesn't have to be a conviction that ends him. There'd be an appeal process after that. So, we could be in that for a long time. But still, the people of Israel should not be cynical. They should realize that there's political problems all around the world. You mentioned the United States and all the balagan that the mess that there was there, and we are not suffering from hyperpolarization the way they are in America.
No.
If you look on the key issues of the day in Israel, whether it's diplomatic issues and security issues and health issues, the people of Israel are more united than they've ever been, not more polarized than they've ever been. And that gives hope that with the right kind of leadership that really focuses on that unity, that we can move forward in a better kind of way. And I think that the people of Israel will become less cynical whenever that happens. And that doesn't have to necessarily be without Netanyahu. It could be any one of the four leaders running for prime minister could put their foot down and say, this is what's going to happen from now.
And I've been here for a long time and I voted in a lot of elections. I still cry when I go into that voting booth. I still think of what a privilege it is that as a Jew living in our country, our old new country, I get to decide who the leader is, whether he's going to be good or bad or she or he or whatever. It is a tremendous privilege. And living in a democracy, despite being surrounded by some of the worst people on the planet with every excuse to go in a different way, I think this is an extraordinary country. And the fact that we have kept those ideals alive with all the differences of opinion here, only some of which we touched on tonight, and people pulling in different directions. I mean, ultimately, you know, we know exactly that this is this is the last stand that we have. And it's still a tremendous privilege to be able to vote and to vote and then to vote again. And I know that it hurts me very much when I hear people say that they're not going to vote because they're just so disgusted with everyone. So put a clothespin on your nose and pick the least worst, but get in there, because otherwise you're letting someone else make your choice for you. And that's kind of sad when you have the ability to do it. I know. Come on, you can't find one? No, but it's something that, God forbid, we start taking this for granted, really. It's because there's a lot of pieces in motion and in play all the time that need to work. Not just talking about Iran and some of the other really big dangers out there. We need to keep this little sliver of a place safe and secure and hopefully have, you know, good leadership, and that the people will somehow be able to insist on it this time, that that the leaders are worthy of the people, because the people are pretty damn amazing. And I'm proud to be an Israeli.
Those yes. Leaders, the people then have to realize that they're good leaders and be the moral of the Purim story is that even after Mordechai went through everything and saved the Jewish people from annihilation, he only had the support of a majority.
I love that
of his
line.
Rov Echav, right? Only most of his brothers agreed with him. There was still somebody who said, you know, if he just hadn't annoyed Haman so much, maybe we wouldn't have gotten into this mess.
But think about it now in perspective.
Great line.
We
it's
just
so true.
Wish we had a leader who had the support of Rov Echav, and then we wouldn't have 4 elections in 2 years.
That's right. But maybe really we'll have a leadership who also realizes the power of each sector. You know, the ultra-Orthodox have many wonderful things about their community. If it's channeled in the right way, they're an awesome contribution to this country when it comes to chesed and other things that they do. The same thing with the Arab sector and the Russians, and everybody within this little mosaic can bring their pieces in. And that's, I think, what really good leadership does, and that I hope we have, is not everybody, it's like when you raise children, not everybody gets the same education. You have to realize everyone's different. The same thing with the different sectors in Israeli society, and be able to, you know, funnel people into what they can do so that we can all be so much greater than the sum of our parts. Gil Hoffman, thank you so much. I mean, I know I'm not the only one who has tremendous respect for you. Your analysis as a journalist, your always cool demeanor, and when you interview people, it's really been a wonderful thing to see over all these years. And I know that you're going to continue to do that, if it's for the Jerusalem Post, if it's in Honolulu, wherever life takes you. So thank you so much for joining us here tonight. Anything you want to add before we sign off?
Just to tell people that if you ever need a speaker in your community on Zoom, I do them at all hours of the night.
Terrific.
You know, I can't really travel right now to the beautiful places that I've seen, including that synagogue in Honolulu where that greeted me with a wonderful shaloha.
Oh, that's great.
Anywhere, day or night, gil@jpost.com. Happy to brief your community ahead of this election. And I appreciate this opportunity, not only to brief these wonderful 105 participants here, but also to share a screen with you, with the great Eve Harrow. Everybody should applaud back home for Eve. And know how lucky you are to have her as part of this program.
Okay. Thank you so much, Gil. Look, I can't wait to take people around Israel for real. The virtual tours are wonderful. The webinars we're going to keep doing because it's a way of getting people out into everybody's living room around the world. But still, there's nothing like being here. There's nothing like seeing these places for yourselves. And so with Purim coming, and as they say, v'nahafochu, right, that everything should turn topsy-turvy. So hoping that everybody gets their vaccines, gets healthy, the world goes back to maybe better than it was, and that you can all come and see what we're doing here in Israel, participate in this magnificent, magnificent country that we have. And I know that for our listeners, for our viewers, who are supporters of One Israel Fund, thank you from the bottom of my heart. I know how hard it has been for you not to be here, for you not to see the projects that you funded. So we're sending you the pictures and we're sending you the videos of the kids playing on the equipment and, well, not the people going into the mikvah, but, you know, but we really appreciate everything that you're doing for us. And just know that we're not stopping here. We're not stopping for 1 minute, not to secure people here and not to make lives better in these communities, because we're not going anywhere. With whatever leadership is here and whatever leadership is in the United States and around the world, The Jews of Judea and Samaria are here to stay. And sometimes the ride is bumpier than others. And it looks like we're about to get onto that section of road. So thanks really everyone for your constant support and interest and sharing and coming onto the webinar, which will be on the website, I believe, tomorrow, www.oneisraelfund.org. And so people won't be able to ask questions, but obviously they can watch it and they can hear what Gil had to say about the elections, as well as the other webinars that we've done in the last few months. As we mentioned, Michal Cutler-Winch was our last one last month. And the virtual tours of different places and different people from around the country and the different communities. A new one coming out this week from Elon Moreh with Asher Mandel, who's the driver on the buses that haven't gone out in the last year. And he misses us as much as we miss him. So with blessings for a wonderful Purim, and health to everybody. And let's drink to that. Gil Hoffman, thank you so much. Shauna, thanks for all the work behind the scenes. Eve Harrow, Director of Tourism and Community Development for One Israel Fund. Take care, everybody. That's it for now.
With global instability on the rise, more and more people are turning to God, realizing now they don't exactly know where to look for guidance. The Bible says the guidance will come from the land of Israel. My name is Jeremy Gimpel. A few months ago, we started an online seminar teaching life-changing biblical wisdom revealed from the original Hebrew and straight from the mountains of Judea. What you will discover is that the wisdom transmitted thousands of years ago is speaking directly to us in our time right now. Join now and get an audio series on the prophecy encoded in the book of Joshua absolutely for free. Just click on the link below or email fellowship@thelandofisrael.com. I don't know how you found this video or what compelled you to click on that link, but I don't believe in coincidence, and I would encourage you to take the next step on your journey toward the land of Israel. I hope to see you at the Land of Israel Fellowship. Shalom.